Good evening. This is the October meeting of the San Luis Obispo County Health Commission. And we will start the meeting with the minutes from our last meeting. Are there any changes or additions or corrections to the meetings, to the minutes from September 10th? There being no changes, corrections, or additions, then the minutes will stand as recorded. We'll move on now to the public comment period. This is the time when anybody that would like to make a comment on something that is not on our agenda may come forward. Is there anyone in the audience that wants to make a public comment? Well, we'll skip right through that one then and move on to the first item on our agenda. The first item on our agenda is SLO County Emergency Medical Services, the EMS, the aircraft and helicopter operations, and the Policy 119 development. And I'd like to welcome Charlotte Alexander, who is the executive director from EMSA, who will make a presentation. You can go to either side.
Thank you.
Thank you very much for being here.
Thank you for having me here. I wanted to introduce Jennifer Shea, who's handing out something to each of you at this moment. Jennifer is the project coordinator at the EMSA, and she'll be speaking to you a little bit later on the trauma system. Dr. Thomas had asked me to come and make a presentation to you on the aircraft helicopter operations policy that the EMSA has for use in the county. Internally, it's known as Policy 119. I think you all received a copy of that in your packet. So I'm not going to read that verbatim. It was pretty a lengthy policy. But I wanted to give you a little bit of background and explain to you what Policy 119 is and what it affects and what it doesn't affect. I wanted to start by saying that residents and visitors in SLO County are very fortunate to have an excellent team of public and private agencies prepared to respond in case of an emergency. Each agency has its unique capabilities, and to assure appropriate response and practice, each agency follows standard and agreed upon policies and protocols for the work they do and for how they work with each other, and that's the context that I'd like to set this Policy 119 within. Policies and protocols, as you can imagine, I could have brought them with me, but it would be a stack about this high, are detailed and lengthy. But well-written policies exist to provide a few clear-cut guidelines that can be applied in the field so that all agencies balance the appropriate response with the safety of the public and of responders. The MSA has specific policy overseeing EMS helicopter operations. That is Policy 119. The policy was developed with input from emergency physicians, paramedics, nurses, and other EMS specialists, and in cooperation with representatives from affected agencies, public and private providers in this case. The current version of the policy was developed with all the stakeholders represented at not just one meeting, but several meetings over the course of not just months, but even a year or so at least. Dr. Thomas specifically charged the MSA to be effective and fair in the development of this policy. I just want to read to you a little bit, a couple of sentences he wrote directly to the EMSA about this policy. It is incumbent upon the EMSA to provide effective and timely review of the quality of care provided by EMS aircraft providers and the appropriateness of utilization of these aircraft. The use of EMS aircraft is not a risk-free endeavor, and the use of an air ambulance is very expensive. These resources are of great value when used appropriately, but are a potentially huge financial burden to a consumer if used inappropriately. Please ensure that effective and fair review is accomplished. So we see Policy 119 as reacting to Dr. Thomas's request to be effective and fair. The policy you have is current as of September 20th, last month, 2007, when changes to it were approved by the EMSA Board of Directors. It's now undergoing some minor editing changes that will be brought before the board again in October, but then it's expected that that will be the final policy in effect for the foreseeable future. I'm happy to review the policy with you right now, what it is, what it affects, and what it doesn't affect, and how it's applied in this county. To set the stage for that, I wanted to give you some statistics that the MSA had gathered from the last year, and that's this page that we just handed out to you. And I wanted to note that Policy 119 deals with but a very small part of all the pre-hospital transports in this county, all the emergency transports in this county, less than 0.5% of all the calls. In 2006, there were 48 pre-hospital air transports in this county. That's about 4 a month. For comparison purposes, there were 55 of these transports in 2004 and 61 in 2005. So we're not dealing with hundreds, okay? We're dealing with more like scores of transports. Of the 48 transports in 2006, more than 70% of them were handled by CalSTAR. And about 23% of the calls that went to the CHP resulted in transports, while about 60% of the calls that went to CalSTAR resulted in transports. After we review the policy, I'd like to talk about what I consider to be a very important aspect of what the EMSA provides, and that is a continuous quality improvement process to review the guidelines that Policy 119 provides. And to review how whether the guidelines are being implemented in the county, whether they're being adhered to. I also want to give you a little bit of context, which I wish our medical director, Dr. Tom Renee, was here to share with you. He had to work today in his emergency room, but he is part of a state EMS authority task force on aeromedical transport. He's been making trips up to Sacramento and around the state to work with the state on some statewide guidelines related to EMS aircraft. I believe Dr. Thomas has attended at least one of those meetings as well. Let me get into the purpose of 119. Policy 119 establishes the procedure for the use of emergency medical services aircraft providing emergency medical care in the county, that is pre-hospital, including air ambulances and other categories of air transport. This does not affect two other very important areas that use aircraft. It's not interfacility transfers, and it's not outside patient care, such as search and rescue. This is strictly emergency, getting patients to the hospital in a pre-hospital setting. It applies to all emergency medical provider agencies operating aircraft in the county, and that would be the CHP and CalSTAR. The CHP helicopter is part of the statewide air operations program of the California Highway Patrol. It's based at the Paso Airport. Its primary mission is to provide law enforcement services, and it has many, many other responsibilities in addition to medical transport. It's staffed with an EMT pilot and a paramedic and can transport only one patient at a time. CalSTAR, which has an air ambulance, and I believe CalSTAR is on the program later today, and they can tell you more in depth about their program. They frequently carry critical patients between facilities, as I mentioned before, interfacility transport for specialized care. It's based in Santa Maria and always responds with a crew, including two critical care flight nurses. It operates under a contract with the county, overseen by the EMSA in accordance with the ambulance ordinance. The EMSA provides services to the county in terms of compliance of county contracts with ambulance providers. It's important, I think, to remember that either helicopter, when it's needed, could be on another mission at any time, in or outside the county. And I think we're very lucky to have both helicopters available in case of an emergency. One question the policy attempts to answer is how the helicopters are dispatched when they're needed. MedCom, which is the Slo County Medical Communications Center, is the dispatch center designated by the EMSA to coordinate emergency medical services aircraft response to the scene of a medical emergency. All requests for and cancellations of EMS aircraft are done through MedCom in the county. It's important to note, too, a ground ambulance and appropriate fire department is dispatched simultaneously when an EMS aircraft is dispatched for additional support or if needed. And when two EMS aircraft are available for response, the closest unit is dispatched first. But if the response time for both aircraft is equal, the air ambulance, meaning CalSTAR, is dispatched first. That's the way the current policy reads. In terms of destination, the policy goes into more detail about what permitted heliports there are in this county. Twin Cities is the permitted heliport in the county. There are permitted heliports in Santa Maria, in Bakersfield, and in Fresno. There's an approved landing site for daylight use only here at French Hospital. And there are landing zones with which add another 15 to 20 minutes of ground transport time to Sierra Vista and Rio Grande. In other words, if a helicopter lands at Oceano, there's another 15 or 20 minutes to get to Rio Grande, or they can get to Sierra Vista if they landed at either Slo Airport or Camp Roberts. The circumstances for use of an EMS aircraft are time. If air transport saves 10 minutes over ground transport to the nearest hospital, and need, and that is medical conditions or injuries warrant the use of an EMS aircraft, or if the patient is in an area inaccessible by ground transport or where response by a ground ambulance would be prolonged. That's essentially what the policy says in about 8 pages. What I mentioned at the beginning was I want to talk about two other things, and that was, one, there is a continuous quality improvement component of what the EMSA provides to the county, and that is the goal of Policy 119 is to use EMS helicopters safely and effectively for those patients who will truly benefit from the services, and in order to provide and ensure the appropriate response to these medical emergencies with the safety of the public and the responders in mind. The EMSA has established a Helicopter Utilization Review Committee. It's called HERC, another acronym. Each month, the EMSA staff review all helicopter calls and transports in the county, and the members of the Helicopter Utilization Review Committee, including public and private providers who are represented on the committee, respond to questions and concerns about those two issues I mentioned before, time and need, all in the interest of continuous quality improvement and, most important, patient care. In using EMS helicopters, it appears that in Slo County, we're doing a good job with scene management and safety while providing excellent patient care. However, we must keep in mind that the use of helicopters is not without significant risk and cost. Every emergency response and operation has inherent dangers. Helicopters have their own unique set of potential problems. For example, helicopter accidents, while they are rare, are frequently fatal, and air ambulance bills can be 3, 5, or even 10 times the cost of ground transport. The Helicopter Utilization Review Committee looks at both time and need when considering the calls. In other words, was a minimum of 10 minutes saved in transporting the patient by air, and was there a critical threat to life or limb? Obviously, I'd like to point out that good communication plays an important role in the outcome of air transport, as does good knowledge of the county and good judgment about interpreting the nature and content of incoming emergency calls. This puts a lot of importance on the responding agency, MedCom, to determine what the need is. And MedCom, CHP, and CalSTAR are all represented during the HERC reviews. It's also important to note that just because an EMS helicopter is requested, dispatched, overhead, on the ground, or helicopter personnel are conducting patient assessment at the scene, this does not necessarily mean that transport by air is appropriate. Knowing when not to use helicopters is as important as knowing when to use them. For example, in general, stable patients who can be transported by ground should not be transported by air unless it's in a remote area, for example, or where no ground units are available. Also, special problems such as patients who are contaminated by hazardous materials, who are violent, or who are in traumatic cardiac arrest should not be transported by air. One other item of note, both the CHP and CalSTAR frequently respond to calls from other counties. Both units are available not just to San Luis Obispo County, but to surrounding counties. And taking one or both of them out of use on a questionable transport might affect their ability to serve more urgent needs. So that's all, there's always a balance going on about the use of helicopters at any given time. The areas of ongoing concern that are being addressed in current HERC meetings include calls near the county borders with Monterey, Kern, and Santa Barbara counties. These often result in communication problems, which dispatch is being used. MedCom is used here in San Luis Obispo County, but there's a different dispatcher out of the other counties. So knowing who's en route, what's happening can be a problem. And secondly, calls not meeting medical need criteria per our established policy. Finally, I just wanted to address quickly nationwide and statewide concerns. The increase in use of air transport has created interest at state and national levels in helping local EMS agencies such as ours standardize our policies and guidelines in order to provide effective oversight. The state EMS authority has established an aeromedical transport task force that's looking at providing statewide guidelines so that local EMS systems have something all to use as a reference point. And they have set several meetings in 2007 and 2008 and are moving forward on that. I mentioned before Dr. Renee is actively involved in that because of our experiences here locally and in surrounding counties. He actually, at a most recent meeting of the statewide task force, got a copy of a national white paper dated July of this year. It's called Air Medical Services Future Development as an Integrated Component of the Emergency Medical Services System. Anybody wants a copy, I'm happy to share it with you. It's very interesting, especially for someone like me who's relatively new to the emergency medical services system, to get a very good background of how the use of EMS aircraft has come about in this country and pretty much currently where it stands. So I'm happy to share this with you if you like. One of the things that struck me in this paper was that it says there has been little design in the evolution of the air medical system, meaning that what's happening in terms of the design of EMS aircraft and the use of EMS aircraft is coming from the ground up, from the local level to the state level to the national level. It wasn't like there's been a lot of design done up top down. And what we're doing here in this county is being combined with what's being done in other counties, particularly through the statewide task force, to try to establish some basic standards and guidelines. In response to a letter from Dr. Renee to the director of the statewide EMS authority earlier this year, right before the first task force meeting, we got a response from Dr. and Dr. Thomas, you want to help me with his name? Aristeguieta, I think. We call him Dr. Caesar. That's his first name. He's the statewide director of the EMS authority. He responded to Dr. Renee about the importance of the statewide task force by saying that governance of the unique issues of EMS air transport services are in need of structure and definitions. It is imperative that principles of good medical care are driving decisions and policies being made for EMS in California. There continues to be multiple EMS air transport issues among base hospitals, local EMS agencies, and EMS providers which deserve attention from the EMS authority. These include registered nurse oversight, treatment protocols when county lines are crossed, again, the jurisdictional, multi-jurisdictional concern, quality improvement issues, destination decisions, and crew safety, which all must be addressed by appropriate state and local parties. A couple of local examples of why a structure, perhaps another rung up the ladder of oversight might be needed. One, for example, at the county level, we have a clear process delineated for oversight of EMS personnel, our EMTs and paramedics that are licensed or accredited by us here in the county. However, no process exists for oversight of air ambulance flight nurses and for reviewing their role in the continuous quality improvement process. Another area is that helicopters in our county are multi-jurisdictional, just as I mentioned before, operating in Slo County, but also in Monterey, Santa Barbara, and other counties. And coordinating the dispatching and tracking of different policies and guidelines and their use in specific situations can be very challenging for the medical personnel involved. With Dr. Renee's continuing interest, we're going to continue attending these meetings and contributing to the development of what I think will be a more effective, coordinated process at the statewide level. I'd like to thank you for this opportunity to give you a quick update. I'd like to thank you for the opportunity for me to be able to get this background together for you and learn a little bit more on my part about the whole system. Jennifer and I are here to answer any questions. Any issues you wanted to raise?
Thank you, Charlotte. We'd never know that you were new at this. Sounds like you've been doing it for a long time and have acquired quite a bit of knowledge. Are there any questions from commissioners for Charlotte? Commissioner O'Dell.
No? No, there it is. Thank you. On your statistics from one of the San Luis Obispo ambulance services and then the Cambria community, I'm in the Cambria area, and at the time of 2006, there was only one unit operating, and they now have two.
We use these numbers as ones that were available to call on. I believe they probably had a backup.
Oh, yes, had a backup, but it was right. It was questionable.
Right. If needed, if there was a multi-casual incident or something like that, they would have that one available.
The backup, a whole network, right.
Yes.
But now they have two units
yes.
full-time there.
Thank you.
Any other questions, commissioners? Okay, then.
I urge you to take full advantage. I know, I believe Suzanne from CalSTAR is going to be here. Please take full advantage of finding out what important services they provide the community. Thank you very much.
Well, thank you very much for being here. We appreciate your time. All right, then next on the agenda, we have Jennifer. Jennifer Shea. Projects coordinator for EMSA Inc. And welcome.
Thank you. Thank you. I work with Charlotte, for Charlotte. And I'm here to give you an update on the EMSA's work on the trauma system plan for the county. Thought I'd start off with a surprising fact from the CDC that trauma is the primary cause of death for people ages 1 to 44. That's nationwide. If I back up and define trauma for you, for example, when I had appendicitis attack a couple years ago, it was rather traumatic for me. And I had to go to the emergency room, and I had to have surgery. However, I was not a trauma patient. That's completely different. A trauma patient is a seriously injured person who requires timely diagnosis and treatment of injuries by a multidisciplinary team of healthcare professionals to diminish or eliminate the risk of death or permanent disability. The majority of trauma injuries in our county are caused by traffic accidents. A trauma system plan is an organized, coordinated effort that delivers the full range of care to all injured patients and is integrated within the local medical and public health systems. The true value of a trauma system is derived from the seamless transition between each phase of care, pre-hospital, hospital, rehabilitation. That also includes the 911 call, the paramedics that respond to you, that take you to a designated trauma center, the treatment you receive there, and the aftercare. Oftentimes, there's lengthy rehabilitation involved. Integrating all those resources to achieve improved patient outcomes. A trauma center is just one component of a trauma system. Other receiving hospitals, ground and air ambulances, even specialty care centers outside of our county are included in a trauma system. Specialty cares outside of our county can include, I know CalSTAR and CHP will fly patients to the burn center in Fresno, or specialty pediatric care centers where do they go? Children's and Madera. And we'll even include that in our trauma system because we require interfacility transfer agreements and a procedure involved for that as well. Although we, San Luis Obispo County, don't yet have a designated trauma center within our county, our unofficial trauma system functions well because we are fortunate to have four quality acute care hospitals. However, trauma centers are required to maintain a higher level of service for victims of multi-system trauma. The background of our trauma system plan, well, it began, the planning began for our trauma system in 2002 with the formation of the Trauma Task Force. And that was a group of healthcare professionals, such as hospital administrators, ER physicians, nurses, surgical specialists, first responders, EMS transport providers, and more, even including state parks and law enforcement were involved in this group. The group of committed volunteers grew to 40 members. The Trauma Task Force became even more motivated when all four local hospitals expressed interest in trauma center designation. Now, the state EMS authority requires counties to have a trauma system plan, whether or not the county has a trauma center. But a trauma system plan is just a plan until there's a trauma center, at least one. Currently, all but one county in California has an approved trauma system plan. Our trauma system plan was approved by the state in October of 2004, although some policy development had not been completed. Unfortunately, by the time our trauma system plan was submitted to the state EMS authority for approval, all four hospitals withdrew their request for trauma center designation. And there were various reasons involved in that, such as administration change and financial concerns at the time. The EMSA, operating with minimal staff, chose to suspend further development of the trauma system plan until a local hospital once again expressed renewed interest in trauma center designation. And now for the current status of the trauma system plan. In March of this year, we received a letter of intent to seek trauma center designation. It was soon followed by two more. Our three interested hospitals then followed up with full proposals requesting trauma center designation. In response to this renewed interest in trauma center designation, the EMSA is proceeding with two work plans simultaneously, side by side. First, there's the update of the trauma system plan, and then there's the trauma center designation process. The work plan goals of the update of the trauma system plan include involve the EMS community in the update process, and that's partially this trauma task force that I mentioned earlier. I don't know if we'll get up to 40 members again, but we're reassembling the trauma task force. Reevaluate the system needs and capabilities, and we're hiring professional trauma system consultants to help us with that as well. Develop pre-hospital trauma policies. We're involving our existing EMSA committees of operations and clinical and our board of directors, and they're all made up of the EMS community stakeholders as well. And we're updating existing trauma system policies through those committees and through the trauma task force. The work plan goals of the trauma center designation process include establish productive communications with all applicants, establish trauma centers and EMSA's participation in trauma registry system, and that's a data collection system that's very important. We'll be collecting specific trauma data and outcome information from the hospitals, forwarding that to the state, and the state is currently devising their statewide trauma data registry and forwarding that to the national trauma data bank, and that will really help in future trauma system planning nationwide. And then we need to evaluate the trauma center proposals, again, with the help of the trauma task force and the consultants, and designate the trauma centers, and then maintain the trauma system. And the EMSA will work with our many resources to complete the implementation of our trauma system. And our resources include, which I've mentioned before, the trauma task force, the EMSA committees and board of directors, which are made up of representatives of the EMS community, professional trauma system consultants, the EMS authority in Sacramento, and the public health department. Ultimately, the approval of the designation of a trauma center and then the further implementation of a trauma system is up to the public health department and the county board of supervisors. We estimate this process could take at least a year before one or more applicants are granted trauma center designation by the public health department, and the trauma system plan is implemented. And visually, this is the trauma system plan, and there's more to be added to it. So it's quite involved, and thank goodness we have lots and lots of people to help us with it. Thank you for the opportunity to present you with an update on the trauma system plan. And both Charlotte and I are available for any questions.
Are there any questions by commissioners? Commissioner O'Dell and then
Horn.
Commissioner Horn.
In the designation, it seems in this county, there should be one facility designated as a trauma center. Is that your goal? You mentioned maybe more.
We currently have three applicants,
yes.
Three different hospitals. It's a very complex system need and capability evaluation that goes on to determine what's best for the whole system, the whole county. And we haven't made any determination yet, and we are going to rely on the Trauma Task Force, some new data, updated data, and from professional trauma system consultants to help us with that.
Well, I would just like to put in again, there should be one trauma center in San Luis Obispo County.
Thank you.
I have a question about the facility. When they designate a trauma center, do you have a designated area that's there and set up for trauma? And then do you have to staff it 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, even though you have nobody in there?
Right.
It can't be used for other things that come along.
Well, you're right. There needs to be a bed available in the ER for trauma patients.
Okay, so you can use the ER. You don't have to set aside a separate area strictly for your trauma.
Not necessarily, no.
Okay.
But you do have to have this on-call staff of specialists available to the hospital if the trauma team is activated. And it's a huge commitment for a hospital to make.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
Go ahead.
Hi, thank you for the presentation. You said that it was the hospitals had backed out previously, and now three hospitals are in. Why would a hospital want to become a trauma center? Is there more reimbursement involved with it?
Mm-hmm.
It's very expensive. It's a strain on the medical staff to keep the specialists on board. Why would they want to?
Perhaps I'm not the best person to answer that, but what I know is, yes, they do get to have a higher level of insurance reimbursement for a trauma patient, for a specialized, trauma patient according to the coding that they use. And it is very expensive. And there is also benefit often from the status of being a trauma center.
Do you have any questions? Dr. Thomas, go ahead.
Chairman Enns, would you like to see if there is any public comment on this?
Well, I had some questions, actually. where is a person transported now that needs to go to a designated trauma center?
Depending on what the patient need is, we don't have a trauma triage criteria in the county right now saying this is what we consider a trauma patient, therefore you go there. However, we do have trauma centers outside of the county. They're over 100 miles away. Our existing hospitals are adequately staffed and provide excellent acute care as they are, whether or not they have the designation of a trauma center.
And so how frequently do we actually have to transport someone to one of these other centers?
We often will transport to the closest facility. It's difficult to transport someone immediately over 100 miles away if they're a trauma patient. You often transport them to one of the local hospitals where they're stabilized. And if they need a higher level of care, then we transport them out to the most appropriate facility, depending if it's pediatric, burn, or more long-term care. So we'll send them out then.
Are there any questions from the audience or comments regarding the trauma center and the EMSA please come forward if you have a question or a comment to make. And just, you can go to the other podium and state your name, please.
I'm Candy Markwith, Chief Executive Officer of Sierra Vista Regional. And to answer your question about why would a hospital do such a crazy thing, it is very, very expensive. Maintaining 24-hour call for the wide variety of physician panels that we have to maintain is extremely costly. But Sierra Vista Regional already maintains that panel right now. Because we are already have the only neurosurgical program in the county, our purpose for applying for trauma is really for patient safety. It's to meet that golden hour to get the patient to the right place as fast as we can. And so that's our reason for applying for trauma. We also have, you know, the only pediatric unit, the only NICU. So by providing the destination to get the patient quickly where they belong is our major reason. I don't know if you've got any other questions of me.
Any questions from the commissioners? No, but sure. Thank you for coming forward and saying that. That
sure.
was very helpful. Yeah. All right, then. Thank you very much.
Thank you. And I have the trauma system plan here if anyone would
in case we want some evening reading.
Yes. Thank you.
It's available on a CD also.
Okay. Thank you very much. Next item on the agenda is the CalSTAR provider, an overview of their services. Suzanne Bradford is here, and is Chris Giller here also? Okay. Welcome, Suzanne.
Thank you for inviting me. It was such a pleasure to come. I actually got so excited that I cut my vacation short. So... I'm still a little bit in vacation mind. You know how that is, that vacation mindset. But I'm delighted to be here, and I have a presentation to show you that tells you what our program is about. It's hard for me to watch myself talk over here. thank you. All right. I am Suzanne Bradford. I'm the Director of Base Operations at CalSTAR in Santa Maria. And I also brought with me Lisa Avalo, who is the mainstay of our base. She's our chief flight nurse. Lisa and I both are nurses. Lisa has, as you can see, lots of initials after her name. I'll talk a little bit about those a little bit later. Lisa and I have been very fortunate to be the two, well, there's three of us, our lead pilot, myself and Lisa, built the base at CalSTAR from the ground up. Sewer, electricity, everything. So we're very proud of the work that we've accomplished. CalSTAR is an air ambulance. We are CAMES accredited, which is the Commission for Accreditation of Medical Transport Services. CAMES is like the JCO, and I'm sure you're familiar with JCO. It's the JCO accreditation for air ambulance services. Every 3 years, we have to go through a survey. We just completed the survey, and we were very fortunate, again, for the third time to pass without having any kind of corrections. So we're very proud of that. CalSTAR Air Ambulance provides two services for the community, both those intra-facility, the hospital-to-hospital transports, as well as the 911 emergency transports on the scene, the pre-hospital transports. We're located at the Santa Maria Airport, and we've been there since 2002. We selected the Santa Maria Airport because it was there was more room for us, primarily. San Luis is a little crowded. And at that time, we were strategically located between our partners Mercy Air in Oxnard and Helicopter 870 in Paso Robles. So it seemed like a good place to be, and we'd be very accessible to the counties that we serve. We still remain and are the only air ambulance service on the Central Coast. 2 years ago, Mercy Air, Mercy Aid in Oxnard backed out of their program and relocated to another part of California. The goals of our transport is to really reach those people in need as quickly as possible with our trained personnel. We fly, and I'll describe this a little bit in more detail, but we do fly with two certified flight nurses, and we offer the level of care that's equal to the receiving institution, recognizing, of course, the limits that are inherent in traveling. We do totally and completely acknowledge that there is always a risk in flying, for sure. We also are very, very cognizant of the fact that our service is expensive. It's very expensive to operate a helicopter base, and that we only want to transport those patients that are in need. And we appreciate the EMSA for that kind of review. We review those ourselves internally as well. So we appreciate that. I can say that over the years, not every call is going to be necessary because you either over-triage or under-triage, that sort of thing, but it does happen. CalSTAR is unique in California. We are a 501c3 nonprofit public benefit organization. We're one of the very few organizations that are nonprofit. I can honestly tell you that the base here at CalSTAR 7 in Santa Maria is completely nonprofit. CalSTAR has been in service for over 24 years. And we serve communities throughout California and also in Nevada. We have 8 rotor wing bases and 1 fixed wing base. And our headquarters is now based in Sacramento. We have that's where we do all our major maintenance. And we have our billing staff and our accounts payable and logistics and those type people. Our base here at Santa Maria is, we have 14 employees, 7 nurses, 4 pilots, me, a couple mechanics. So between 14 and 16, depending on our part-time population. CalSTAR has transported in there over 24 years over 33,000 patients, both those 911 scene calls and interfacilities. Another unique part of CalSTAR, which the community here really, really appreciates and profits from personally, is our membership program. As a nonprofit, we're able to present a membership program to the citizens of our communities we serve, and this assures them that it's not an insurance policy, it's an assurance program where for a small annual fee, if they are ever transported by CalSTAR or a reciprocal air ambulance, they will not ever see the bill. We will bill the third party, and what's left over, CalSTAR just writes that off. So we have a lot of memberships in our in this county, primarily in our more remote areas where they know that the air travel transport would be necessary for them. The other thing that's real important to know is that we do not charge counties or hospitals for any of our services. And that's always been a myth and a question that I get very often. So I wanted to emphasize that any kind of transport, we bill the Medi-Cal, Medicare, the insurance. And we're a very transparent company. We have about a 54% bad debt write-off. So even though, yes, our service is very expensive, we have a 54% bad debt write-off. So it's an expensive operation. There we go. Here on the Central Coast at Santa Maria, we operate a Bell 222 helicopter. And if any of you are interested in what that is, it's a big machine that goes very fast in a straight line. The Bell 222 is a little bit larger. It's the largest aircraft in our fleet of helicopters, and it's selected in this area for 2 reasons. One is that we know that our transports are going to be long. We transport to many different areas, Fresno, Los Angeles, and the Bay Area primarily. And we needed a helicopter that would be able to do those long transports without a refueling. Also, what we call an IFR, an instrument flight rule platform, which means that we can fly when the marine layer is at, not to the ground, but at a certain level. So we are able to take the IFR, our IFR pilots are trained, and we're able to like pop through the fog layer, because you know it sits, you know how it sits. And we can pop through that with our IFR capability and then get to transport the patient that way. We don't transport what's called in high IFR conditions. So we just want to pop out of that fog layer, which really does help in this community. As you heard before, Charlotte say that CalSTAR does serve several counties, Santa Barbara, Ventura, Kern, Monterey. Sometimes we even go as far as Kings County. And we've even been called to go to Mojave. I'm not sure what county that is, but we are a 24/7 operation, and we are exclusively for patient transport. We have no other service that we provide other than patient transport. We transport with two advanced practice nurses, and I might say that they our advanced practices and our standardized procedures and are reviewed with our, of course, our corporate medical director, but also with the Board of Registered Nurses for the State of California, and these protocols are approved. That allows the nurses to do transport through multi-jurisdictional areas. Registered nurses they're a little bit different than the paramedics in that when you're a registered nurse, you can practice anywhere in the state of California. You don't have to go by county and county and county. You have to get relicensed if you're going to practice in another state. But other than that, in California, we can transport ourselves anywhere within California and practice nursing. Our nurses that do, for example, in South Lake Tahoe have two licenses. They have Nevada and California, so they'll be able to transport both. We also have state-of-the-art equipment. Our helicopter, and I'll show you some pictures of some of the equipment in our cabin. Our nurses are able to really take that patient from a hospital to a higher level of care and maintain that higher level of care during that transport. So the risk to the patient of having anything untoward happen to them during a transport is minimized. And also, I'm very proud to say that our dispatch for CalSTAR is Slo County Cal Fire. We are dispatched through MedCom, as you'd heard before, and then MedCom calls Cal Fire to dispatch us directly. Cal Fire has a big responsibility in that because they maintain our flight following. They check on us every 15 minutes. So we have all these safety mechanisms already in place. It's the standard practice in the industry. It is standard practice for CalSTAR. Cal Fire is just an excellent partner. CDF Cal Fire has been dispatching CalSTAR for over 20 years, so throughout California. They're also very good for us because we go to so many different areas. Their radios work for us. The capabilities in our air ambulance are vast. As I said, our cabin is large, and we have a lot of equipment that's identical to the equipment that's in the emergency room or the intensive care unit. We have an LTV 1000 transport ventilator that will ventilate adults and babies. Invasive line monitoring. Our nurses are very highly trained in flight physiology. Again, we have two nurses on board that specialize in pediatric, high-risk obstetrics, critically ill, and critical trauma patients. They have a lot of requirements to meet, even to come to CalSTAR. They have to have at least 5 years, three to five years of practice in an emergency department or a critical care unit before they even get to interview. And we require a critical care registered nurse, certified flight registered nurse, neonatal resuscitation provider, advanced cardiac life support, pediatric advanced life support, and transport nurse advanced training course certifications. And these, they have to keep their continuing education up. So that we really do require a tremendous amount of skill sets. They also have to do clinical practice in our hospitals. probably 8 to 10 hours a year of clinical, 8 to 10 clinical rotations a year, when each rotation's about 8 hours. Many of our nurses go over to Madera Children's Hospital to do the intensive care, pediatric. We use Cottage Hospital, Santa Barbara, Marion Hospital, and Santa Maria. We have lots of different additional medications on board. As I said, our nurses have a standard scope of practice. We can do rapid sequent induction if it's necessary for intubation, intubating a patient who is in respiratory arrest. Remember, these are the capabilities that we have. We don't do these very often. We do very few intubations. We're very, very, very conservative in what we do, but we have them available. The dual cardiac monitor, we can transport two patients. So we have that duality with our monitoring, and of course the 12-lead EKG. So we have a lot in there. Our 911, these are actual transport pictures here on the Central Coast. As you know, as Charlotte had said, our 911 scene transports are governed by the EMSA, the EMSA policy 119, and you've just heard the review of that, so you don't need to know. This picture is of the Oceano Dunes. It's one of the areas that we do transport because it's so difficult for the ambulance services to get far out into the dunes. So we're unable to fly in, transport the patient back. Again, we transport the patient, the trauma patient, the 911 patient, to the closest hospital with a helipad. We have to save a minimum time of 10 minutes. And what's new in the new policy, that's just not out yet, but it's going to be, is where there are, you know, some of our remote areas, there's going to be an expedited launch process, which we're very, very happy about. We have this in Santa Barbara County as well, where if there's an, let's use the sand spit, for example, because that's not accessible by any kind of ground service. And when there's an injury out in the sand spit, we will, or the helicopter resource will be called to respond. And it gets us up and going, or it gets the service up and going. It could be H-70 as well. But it gets us up and going, and if they find, once the first responders get there, they find that it's not needed, that CalSTAR is not needing, they cancel us and turn us away. But at least we have those resources going. If you can kind of picture a fire, you know, when you have a fire, they'll dispatch 4 or 5 different resources to get it going, and then they call them off if it's not necessary. And it's the same process for our service. So we're hoping that'll allow us to get going very quickly instead of waiting 10, 15, and sometimes 20 minutes to be requested. And we're very happy for this part in the policy. Highway 101. We also bring, we work very well with our partners in the EMS community, the first responders, fire, the San Luis ambulance. We're a great team, and we bring our expertise, and they have their expertise, and we bring that all to the patient, all to the scene. And we've had some very good working relationships with the first responders in all our communities, and we'll continue to do so. We do bring a higher level of care because of the two nurses. But as you can see, when there's something that's very, very critical, like this slide, you need all the hands you can get. Oftentimes, we will be requested, and we will land, and the nurses will assess the patient and realize that the patient is not critical to be transported. And that, so we always keep the ambulance going, and then they will stop, and the ambulance will take over, and we'll hand the care back off to the ambulance, the paramedics. Again, we do provide that advanced practice during our transport. This is the inside of our cabin. You can see it's spacious. All our equipment is very compact. It's all tied down, it's secured, it doesn't fly over the place. The other thing that you might notice is that the nurse is able to write in the helicopter pretty legibly. People ask me very, very often, isn't it uncomfortable? Isn't it bumpy and kind of No, it's not. In fact, most of our patients that we transport aren't usually too aware of their surroundings when we have to transport them. But when we do follow up with them, the one thing that they will say to us is that, I didn't remember much, but I just remembered it was very smooth. So if ever you ever have an opportunity to fly with us as a ride-along only, we are the airline you don't want to fly, you'll notice that. It's very, very smooth, and that's that Bell 222, which is a smooth aircraft. But it really makes it's very nice. The other good purpose for an air ambulance is for remote locations. And as you know, we have a beautiful Central Coast, and we have a lot of remote recreational areas. And there's places that people fall off cliffs and fall into rocks and so on and so forth. And it's very hard to get to. We've had to fly in, land at the top of a mountain, and then hike down, the nurses hike down to the patient and figure out ways to get the patient back to the helicopter or so on and so forth. So it's very useful for remote locations. And you never know where you might be needed. And aren't you glad this wasn't in this county, but it was in our area? The resources that you have here and for air resources, air EMS resources, is the Bell 222, the CalSTAR Air Ambulance, and the California Highway Patrol Rescue Aircraft H-70. I like their color, but they're not as pretty as ours. As you know, I'll just review this very quickly. Our receiving hospitals with helipads are Twin Cities Community Hospital, French Hospital with limited landing zone capabilities. We do utilize as close hospitals, we do utilize the Marion Hospital Medical Center. They do have a helipad, and sometimes on the dunes and sometimes out in California Valley, they're the closest hospital with a helipad. And Kern Medical Center is a level 2 trauma center. Very rarely, but there are places way east in Soda Lake and California Valley out in there where Kern is the closest facility. But more than like, most often we're transporting the patients to Twin Cities, French, or Marion. Our interfacility transports. Those are our hospital transports. And I have to tell you a little bit about this slide. It's not a HIPAA violation. This is John, and John volunteered to be our poster child a couple of years ago. John is a cancer patient. He was 2 when he was diagnosed. Oops, now see, it had a life of its own here. And, I'll just leave it here, I think. It's a little. Okay. So John's family brought him down to the helicopter because they were concerned that he might have to be flown at one time, and they wanted to get him familiar with the helicopter. And, of course, we just had the best time with John. He was just very sweet. It's just doing it all by itself here.
Do you want me to go back? I don't know.
Yes. Can you try to go back, please? I don't know what it's doing. You want to? So we had the best time with John, and then the next slide that I showed you, he decided he wanted to be a pilot, and we were doing a little pilot training with John. But again, you can see the capabilities, the equipment inside our aircraft. So, let's see if it goes now. I'm sorry. That.
Is it going?
You know, I wonder if the battery's going out on this.
Oh,
my. That's what mine does. That's the only thing I know. If it doesn't work, it's the battery. So this is John with one of our pilots getting his first training. Next, please. Just to give you a little review of hospital and facility transport services in our area. Of course, patients can go by private vehicle. There's no medical crew and there's no care, but you can take as many patients as the car will hold. And it's, of course, available 24/7. You have the ground ambulance, who have the medical crew of an EMT and a paramedic, and they are ALS. The advanced life support care is provided. They most often can carry 2 patients, and they're available 24/7. And in this county, we have a critical care transport, also San Luis Ambulance operates. And they have an EMT, a paramedic, and an RN. and they are also an ALS providers, and they have a wider scope of practice because they have an RN on board. They usually can carry one patient, and they're available 24/7, and sometimes they may be on call. I'm not sure what it is in this county, but some counties the nurses are on call. You also have a critical care transport that comes out of Cottage Hospital too, with a pediatric team that transports patients. They come in their rig to our hospitals and transport patients down to Cottage Hospital. And then you have the air ambulance, where we have two registered nurses. We have a highly qualified critical care and advanced practice skills. We can carry two patients, and of course, we're available 24/7. So that's what we have available in our community. It's a nice balance of all services, I believe. Next, please. Next. Just to give you an idea of why, when you would use a helicopter in terms of out-of-patient time, out-of-the-hospital risk time for those critical ill patients, for us to get to UCLA Med, and these times are not very specific because, granted, we have Twin Cities and Aurora Grande Hospital, which is going to make a difference with time. I'm just giving you a ballpark picture, but to transport a patient by air to UCLA would be 50 minutes, and of course, ground transport would be 3 to 4 hours. To go to the Community Regional Medical Center in Fresno, which is a level one trauma center, the burn center is there. Again, it's a 45-minute air time, 3 to 4 hours by ground. Children's Hospital Central Coast, which is also what we call Valley Children's or Children's Madera, 40-minute transport time, 3 to 4 hours. And Stanford University, it's about 1 hour and 4 hours. I actually recently drove down to UCLA Med Center. It took me 6 hours. So it only takes you 2 hours to get to Los Angeles, and then the rest is, you know. So that just gives you an idea what when a physician requests us for that in our facility, there's a need that we want to reduce that out-of-hospital risk, that transport time, or utilize the advanced practice services and or the advanced practice services of the nurses. Next, please. Now, we have some challenges, and we have really a struggling base and for several reasons, and just a couple of them I'm going to just share with you. One thing, and I'll give you some more details on this, but we have a beautiful Central Coast. That's a challenge for us. The current policies do not consider air ambulance as the preferred mode of medical transport. We're at the same level playing field as the air rescue helicopter. And our financial survival at CalSTAR 7 right now is at risk. And there are a few select physicians in the community that do not support CalSTAR and are verbal about it. Next, please. Our beautiful Central Coast. Well, the reason that we're here is that the population density is small. Both Santa Barbara County and San Luis Obispo County, if you combine the population of those two counties, it equals just a little over half of the city population of San Jose. So we don't have a lot of population here. We have little violent crime, all these good things about living here at this wonderful coast. And so therefore we also have fewer traumatic incidents. And by this is Pismo Pier, if you didn't know. So that's the good and the bad news about living here in our area and trying to maintain the survivability of an air ambulance service. Next, please. The policies that are not are the EMS current policies don't consider air ambulance as a preferred transport. And the next slide, please, is a pretty busy slide. But I just wanted to show you a comparison between a private air ambulance and a public civil tax-supported air rescue service. And there are some significant differences. Most counties in the state of California do not use a civil air EMS, a civil air service as a primary provider of medical transport services. The first thing is that our primary purpose is to respond to emergency calls. And civils have police, fire, or other primary services. We have a flight crew of two attendants. The civil, the public aircraft will have a minimum of one attendant. We're immediately available. 24 hours, 7 days a week. Sometimes civil aircraft are not available at all times. Our scope of practice is more advanced with two flight nurses. The civil aircraft has one paramedic on board. We have two nurses and one paramedic. We do have very, very strict medical control and direction through our company medical director, through the board of registered nurses, and we have an extensive quality improvement program. Medical control oftentimes with civil helicopter programs is unknown. We don't know. They don't necessarily need to follow the county policies and procedures and guidelines. We must adhere to federal, state, and local statutes, the FAA, federal and state laws, which gives us, because we're a Part 135 air carrier, we have to adhere to much more strict safety guidelines, maintenance guidelines in our helicopter. The civil air may not be required to comply with these minimum standards. So there's a safety factor involved. We must be requested to respond to any 911 emergency. We cannot just fly when we think we hear something on the radio. We have to be requested through the MedCom system, through our 911 dispatch system. The civil helicopter can respond at any time. They can self-dispatch, self-respond without EMS authority. We collect fees from the patients, as you know, and for the civil air, there are no fee. All taxpayers pay those bills. We also must be authorized by the local EMS agency to provide pre-hospital patient transport. And on the civil side, the request from the dispatch center is deemed authorization of the aircraft operated by a civil air service. So with our contract with the county, we must meet certain criteria, and we work very hard to meet those criteria with response times and need and so forth. And this is a real challenge for us, because if you could look at the one of the probably, and I'll explain to you why, because being on the same level playing field with the civil the CHP helicopter really strains us financially. Next slide, please. We do have a low flight volume. We have a low flight volume for several reasons. One, we have a beautiful Central Coast. We don't have a lot of trauma. We don't have the population. And for the past 5 years, we've not been able to support our base sufficiently. So it's been a financial drain on our company. For example, through September of this year in this county, we have transported only 16 scene transports and 15 interfacility transports in the county. In 2006, we did 30 scene transports, completed transports, and 50 interfacility transports in the county. So if you look and compare those numbers, as my board of directors does, this year is not looking very good for us. And it is expensive to operate an air ambulance service. There's no question we have a lot of extensive training with pilots and nurses and maintenance, and we do a lot of community events to CalSTAR's expense. On the plus side, we do receive grants for needed and necessary equipment, and we receive donations also from our community, Quota International, Walmart, Chumash Casino, Santa Barbara Foundation. So we've been our community leaders have been very generous to us with us. Next, please. And I think Charlotte also mentioned this, but this is another comparison for you to see why our board of directors at CalSTAR is concerned about the viability of the service in this community. In 2006, 29% of the transports were completed by the CHP, and 71 were done by CalSTAR. In 2007 through June, and these are EMSA statistics, 58% of the transports are done by CHP, and only 37% by CalSTAR. Next slide, please. But we're here to we persist. Lisa and I just really are very passionate about CalSTAR and the service that it does provide to our community. And this is why we want to stay in the community and why we persist at trying to make things better. First of all, we have very strong community support. We have a very large membership program here in the community. Very surprising, because it evolves. It's by word of mouth. It's not so much me going out to I've made lots of presentations, but it comes through homeowners groups and recreational groups, and we have a lot of strong community support. We are also your only air ambulance service from Salinas to Los Angeles. We like it here. We are very active participants in community activities and community events. We are actively involved, Lisa, especially in EMS training at our local colleges and other training venues. We have a wonderful grant. We got a grant for this wonderful simulated mannequin that we bring down to this area every year and ask our paramedics, invite them to come and work with SimMan. So we really want to be active partners in training as well. And I believe that most of the medical community does see that CalSTAR has a value. I believe that it does for our community. So that's what we are. Next slide, please. And I thank you very much for listening, and please be safe. And good evening. And we're available for any comments or questions.
I do have a question for you, Suzanne. Why is there such a huge difference between CHP transports last year versus this year? And wasn't that ambulance new, or wasn't that new to CHP this year as opposed to last year?
What was new?
The helicopter that they're transporting with now.
No, they've had a helicopter here for 7 or 8 years.
Oh, I wasn't aware of that.
97.
So do you have any reason why you see such a discrepancy?
I have some speculation, but I really think that is really something that needs to be investigated. Yes. I don't know, really.
Who determines who gets called?
Yes, that was my question.
Through policy 119, it really is basically MedCom dispatch.
Oh, that sort of gives us an answer.
Yeah, you have two questions. One, your 54%, which you must get then from donations and grants and things, or how do you balance out?
Yes, that's a very good question. We do not get any federal funding other than Medicare, Medi-Cal. We do get foundation grants through foundations and grants for a lot of our equipment. We are also supported a little bit by the trauma centers up in Northern California. The trauma centers in Northern California were there to, they've pretty much founded, with a McKesson grant, founded CalSTAR so many years ago. So John Muir Hospital and some of the Sutter hospitals are affiliate members and do support us. But other than that, we try to stay very self-sufficient. This year, and I have to share with you too, is that I have two challenges, and one is my board of directors to try to keep our basis, you know, sustainable, and dealing with these dilemmas of this low flight volume in the county. The flight volume in San Luis Obispo County, very similar demographics, is 50% higher, twice as many calls in Santa Barbara County. So, and it's not that we need jillions of calls. You've seen the numbers. They're not large numbers. It's those that we lose because a civil error has taken them, or the patient wasn't evaluated, are the ones that really hurt us. Did I answer your question?
Yeah.
Okay.
Thank you for the presentation. I have a whole bunch of questions, but let me start with trauma designation, kind of bringing together the what we were talking about earlier. What would trauma designation for one or more of our hospitals mean to CalSTAR? Well, obviously some of them have heliports,
well,
and don't.
Right. At this time, and I have heard that Sierra Vista is, I hear you just laughing. Oh, well, I have heard that, and I know Sierra Vista is very interested in a helipad, so that we're working very, working with them to hopefully have that happen. But at this time, there's no, the trauma designation is that you take the patient to the closest hospital with a helipad, or, and ground ambulances has very similar kinds of rules. With a trauma center designation in the county, then we'll be able to take trauma patients to that trauma center. Now, if without a helipad, it'll be more challenging for us, of course. So it probably would mean if at this time without a helipad, we would work closely with the county. We do have some opportunities. We do have a contract with Camp San Luis, with a landing zone at Camp San Luis, which is only about 10 minutes away from the hospital. And we use that for interfacilities. So we would have to be very creative.
Okay. The other question is, it's sort of a basic question. MedCom, then, is the one who dispatches out to either you or the CHP. And they follow the policies in this policy. But something's changed from that last year to this year. Where do we find out what has changed and get that information out?
I honestly don't know. I think you could maybe query through the EMS agency to see what types of maybe the demographic, maybe it's changed. You know, the pastoral bulls is in the north part of the, they're in the north part of the county, and we're in the south part of the county. Maybe there's possibly more trauma up north than there is down south, or I don't know. I can't answer that question.
Okay, thank you. Dr. Thomas, is this a mystery? Is this a political quagmire that we're...
Political.
I don't know the answer to why that has changed one year to the next. I think that we could look at the locations of where the dispatch calls have come from. They're not large numbers, as you see. And so year to year, you're going to have some variability. Where we end up at the end of the year, I don't know. MedCom is dispatching based on who can respond the fastest. If it's an equal response time, then CalSTAR will get the call. Preferentially, but if the CalSTAR is not going to be able to respond as fast as the CHP, then the community, EMS community that has put together this policy 119 has agreed that whoever can get there fastest and get the patient to the hospital the fastest should do that transport it is in the patient interest to get the patient to the hospital as fast as possible.
Where is your helicopter based again?
In Santa Maria.
In Santa Maria, and the CHP is based where?
Paso Robles.
In Paso Robles. Okay, I see the problem. Thank you.
We have, various other situations in other counties that are very similar, and other counties that we work, the EMSA has agreed to, they feel that it's worth the wait of a few more minutes to have an air ambulance come, or oftentimes the rescue aircraft will come on scene and perhaps be the first responder or do the rescue, and then the air ambulance comes in to do the transport. Questions?
I think we've had all the questions from commissioners. Thank you very much. That was really a very comprehensive report. Now, is there anybody in the audience that has questions for Suzanne? No. Okay, thank you very much. Thank you all for being here and making this an interesting evening. Now we'll move on to the Public Health Department report from Dr. Thomas.
Good evening, commissioners. I have a fairly short report. First report, Jeff Hamm, health agency director, was here a couple of months ago and talked about developing the direction to come back with a potential service level reduction if we were required to reduced budget. The Board of Supervisors has scheduled a October 30th a special session on the budget, and asking for information from all the departments, the Assistant County Administrator during their budget update said that they would be coming back essentially with a proposal for a hiring freeze, obviously hiring freeze with a option to try and demonstrate the need for that position to maintain public health or safety, so that a firm freeze rather than an absolute freeze. I'm not sure at this point whether we'll be coming back in November or not, but they're not bringing that specific list forward on October 30th. However, we are moving into budget preparation mode for 809, so we will do the annual diligence in coming forth with a budget. Last month, there was a question about water purveyors, people who drive water around on trucks for people whose wells have gone dry. And you have to have a state certificate to do that. And the state inspects the transporters annually, and also there's annual testing of the water source. It has to be a, quote, approved domestic water source in order to provide water. So I see that the person who brought up the question last month isn't here, but let the minutes reflect that we answered the question. And there are a couple of commissioners, I think at least one commissioner had I wasn't here last month, so brought up the question for us to bring information back on.
I have another question. The state has to certify that water, by virtue of being transported, is potable and meets all the criteria for good drinking water. But there are no criteria for water wells currently, are there, that I know of? So people could have water wells that have potentially non-potable water. Is that correct?
Small water systems, which I think is over three households on a water system, and I can get double-check that, they have to have water testing done. They're regulated by county environmental health. The large systems are regulated by the state, but the small water systems are regulated by our county. So they have to have testing on an interim basis, and I think it's annual testing. The individual, if you just dig a well and put it in, then it has to pass some initial tests, but then once you have a private well, that once you get the well certificate, then there are not further testing required. But it certainly is prudent to, on an interval, see how the water's doing.
What's the process that operates by? If there's, say, three or four households on a well, does the county, how do they track that?
I'll have to go back and ask my environmental health staff exactly how they track that.
You're finished with your report?
That is the end of my report. Any questions?
That was a short report. Well, thank you very much. Okay, so moving right along, we have our Health Commission updates. The only update that I have, and I did send all of the commissioners the email about the obesity talk on October 18th that's being held. This is one of the outreach activities of the Obesity Task Force, and it's a panel just for the public's knowledge. You would need to call. It's being held at Kennedy Club Fitness, the one on Tank Farm Road. The number, if one wants to attend, is 800-483-6387. And that is this Thursday, starts at 6:30, will run till 8 p.m. And the basic subject is making weight loss a family affair. And the speakers will be Ann McDermott, Michael Framberger, Mary Oates, and Dr. Bravo. So I think that it's going to be a very interesting talk. Anybody that can go is certainly encouraged to do so. And this is your obesity task force at work. We're moving forward. The letters for the RFPs have gone out. We haven't got anything back, I don't suppose. The obesity task force is certainly active and moving forward with the recommendations that were given to them last year. So we'll move on to the commissioners. Let's start at my left. Commissioner Massey. All the way to the left. Okay, his microphone didn't work, but he says he has nothing to report. So we'll move forward. Commissioner Grena.
Nothing to report.
Commissioner Shimousis.
I have several things. Just kind of piggybacking on what you said about your obesity task force work, there is an obesity, an obesity class is now being offered through CHC. I didn't know if that was announced or not, but that was through my Adult Services Policy Council meeting. Also, I'm just going to go down the list of the announcements. Elias Neme, I think that's how he pronounces his last name, with the Senior Nutrition Program, announced that there is, for Slo County residents 60 and older who make less than $18,800 a year or $25,500 married, are eligible to receive $20 worth of coupons for farmers market in Slo County for fresh fruits and vegetables. The number to call for that is 541-3312. Those coupons will expire the end of November. And Michael Peppenberg with the Veterans Services talked about the new ride-on services available for veterans in Slo County, and they offer $3 transportation from, it's a door-to-door service for veterans going to Santa Maria, needing transportation to either Santa Maria, the Veterans Hospital in Los Angeles, or Santa Barbara. And they go both ways. Again, that's a door-to-door service for those veterans, coordinated through Ride-On. And the Active Aging Task Force of San Luis Obispo County is sponsoring a senior fitness testing, and it's free. I have a flyer that Gene White's help, I will put up on the screen. It's Sunday, October 21st. It's being offered at the St. Joseph's Catholic Church in Nipomo from 10 a.m. to 4 p.m. For more information, you can call Best Care Home Health at 782-8600 or Area Agency on Aging at 541-0384. Last bit of information that I thought was quite encouraging is that both Assemblyman Blakeslee and Senator Maldonado are now sending reps to that meeting on a monthly basis. So that's it.
Okay, so we have on our screen the flyer that Commissioner Shimousis was reading from. And while you're looking at it, we can go ahead and move to you are finished with your report.
Yes.
We can move to Commissioner Hicks.
I attended the last HIV consortium meeting, and there was also one tonight. Unfortunately, I wasn't able to go to it because I'm here, but we had a wonderful agenda, so I'm unhappy that I didn't get to go to it, but anyway, I'll hopefully get some good minutes and I can report back later. This is a very interesting committee to be on, and I really enjoy it. They say there's more and more problems now with the HIV population that they're treating. with behavior, and there were some real serious problems with trying to find some people with their housing needs and problems there. The Ryan White Services grant was reduced by about $4,364. And one of the most important things I wanted to report about was the needle exchange program. It's been a huge success, and I asked for some statistics on it, and I'll share those with you in one moment. Their next phase is to move into San Miguel, and that was going to happen back in July, and I don't know if they got started there yet. Maybe Dr. Thomas can tell me if they did get started in San Miguel yet for the needle exchange.
I think we're going to the Board of Supervisors for our updated report on November 2nd or November 3rd.
Okay, thank you. But overall, it's been a wonderful success, and the information that Jason Wells shared with me is, first of all, it's Wednesday nights from 5:30 to 7:30. It's at 2191 Johnson Avenue, Public Health Department. Must be over the age of 18. It's one-to-one exchange for any needles, up to 30 syringes. There's other HIV prevention materials and substance abuse treatment referral available at that time. They also do HIV and Hep C testing during the exchange hours. The clients that do the exchange for the needle exchange are given a small sharps container for disposal and safe return of the syringes to the exchange. All these services are free. The stats right at this moment, there's approximately 35 different non-repeat clients that come weekly. 75% of them are male, 25% are female. Majority of the ethnicity is white. Approximately 50% are opiate users and 50% are meth users. And as of July 18th, there was over 3,000 needles that were exchanged, syringes that were exchanged. But they're really proud of how well this has turned out. They want people to know that it's they're available for them. Don't be afraid. Don't be ashamed. Just be safe. So I promised that I would announce that at our meeting, and hopefully the public will know that this can be used. And that's my report. Thank you.
Very much. Commissioner Horn.
Yes, I normally go to Children's Services Network, but they have undergone quite a bit of change. And as it has been, it is no longer set up as Children's Services Network, but has various programs that you can attend. And so I'm not quite sure what I'm going to be doing since this is going away or has gone away.
I'm sure we'll find something for you to do. Commissioner Warren?
Yes, I attended the Drug and Alcohol Advisory Board, and there was a lot of discussion about the training that was done by Dr. Minkoff, who came from Harvard to discuss co-occurring disorders, and that was for both the behavioral health departments of mental health and drug and alcohol, and the board members were invited to that. I think at least a third of them were there, and some of the, I think most all of the mental health board were there. It was very, very good conference. It was just excellent, and hopefully the board members there will be discussing it in their retreat next week. Thank you.
Thank you. And Commissioner O'Dell.
Yes, from the Mental Health Board, Governor Schwarzenegger red line, I guess they call it, the homeless funds from the state of California toward all the counties in California. But I'm happy to say that thanks to Karen Baylor, the Director of Public Behavioral Health, and Jeff Hamm, the Agency Director, and the County Administrator, there still is a homeless program. It's been cut, but there still is a homeless program going on in San Luis Obispo County in spite of that.
Thank you. Thank you all, Commissioners.
Moving on to the reports, the Legislative Committee, Commissioner Shimousis.
Yes, the Legislative Committee continues to meet on a regular basis. We are meeting with Jeff Hamm, who is assisting us with bringing us up to speed on the legislative process and how we can best interact with that in terms of supporting the Board of Supervisors with their legislative platform. And we will keep the commissioners appraised of that as we move through that process. And the bills that come up that are of special interest. So stay tuned.
Thank you very much. I understand there's no report from community education. Does the budget committee have a report, Commissioner O'Dell? Okay. Then down to nominating. Commissioner Hicks.
We have a report. After a long, long waiting for the three applicants that were waiting for to be interviewed, we interviewed three of them, Jesse Arnold, Gene Knox, and Pam Munson. And the nominating committee unanimously agreed that all three were excellent choices to have in our alternate file. We did explain to them that they were alternates. And so we did meet with them, and we do agree that all three of them will be excellent choices. One of the applicants that interviewed us, as well as we interviewed him, asked if I could get bios from each and every health commissioner, just so they could understand if we're indirect providers, providers or consumers, and a little bit about our backgrounds and maybe what expertise we bring to the board. I thought it was kind of a nice thing. It only has to be a sentence or two. Do you have any thoughts about this? Sarah?
No. Who wants these? I mean, is it? Are we supposed to give this to you?
I'll do it. I'll take the project on if you send it to me. I'll be happy to take on the project, and maybe then I'll forward it after I do it to Jean.
Maybe
we can put it on our webpage.
I suppose we could do that. I don't know. Everybody, when they apply to be a commissioner, submits a resume, and so I think all that information is in there. And the resume, Jean has those resumes, and I don't know, what is your feeling about this? I mean, do you think it'd be nice to have a little blurb? I mean, you know, like, how do you do? I'm a registered nurse, and I'm a direct provider. I mean, is that what we're looking at?
Well, I was wondering about it. On the web side, it lists the members of the commission, right? And just a one-liner or something could be what their background. I can't see an extensive necessarily. Dr. Thomas.
If it's going to be a one-line sentence, I would ask that each of you write your one-line sentence so that you're not asking Gene or I to pull what would be the term?
We have the picture.
Yes. Well, pull the most important thing in your life out of your CV.
All right. So is there any objection to a one-liner of just saying what it is you do and what category you're serving under? Actually, that probably is not a bad thing at all.
No, I think that would be fine.
Yeah. Huh. Okay. All right, then we'll do that. Jan, you probably don't have to do anything if we just submit them to Jean and she'll get them to the webmaster or whoever it is that puts those things in there.
I was just trying to save Jean some time, and I know she's already a very busy woman, but if that works for you, that's fine with us.
Okay. So I would say, you know, limit it to your, you know, your profession and the category under which you're serving, and if they're not related, then I guess some other reason why you're serving, maybe.
Madam Chair, would you send out an email to all the commissioners, including those who are not able to be here tonight?
You betcha. I'll be happy to do that, and I'll get that out in the next day or so. Thank you, Commissioner Hicks. It's not a lot of work. It's an easy thing, I think. Okay. That ends all the committees. Now, next month, we are having a very comprehensive report on domestic violence. And Pam Hetherington and Penny, Commissioner Shimousis, have been working very hard on this program, and it's very exciting. I hope that there'll be a lot of people that will watch it as well. So get the word out that we're going to have a really exciting Health Commission meeting in November. And that's all I have to say. And what would you like to say, Commissioner Shimousis?
I just wanted to add that Commissioner Hetherington asked me to let the viewing public as well as the commissioners know that we are attempting to get multiple agency input from this process. Generally, when you think of domestic violence, you think of the Women's Shelter Program and maybe law enforcement agency, but there are so many other aspects of this situation and this I don't know, for lack of a better word, phenomenon, that it really is going to be quite interesting and I think informative. So I do encourage people to tune in.
Thank you all. If there's nothing else, I'll entertain a motion to adjourn. I think it's unanimous that we adjourn. Thank you all very much.